in association with Newsarama. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, a nice conversation with Keith R.A. DeCandido. Keith has been writing the Farscape series for Boom Comics. We're almost done with the first arc. We'll be discussing that and future plans for the series, as Rockne O'Bannon has not just these Farscape books coming up, but a Dargo adventure and some other plans along the line. And we get into a big conversation about his involvement as an editor and writer for the Star Trek Pocketbook paperback series. Keith was one of the creators behind the Starfleet Corps of Engineers. He also had an interesting line of books about the Klingon Empire. Those are just a couple of the 16 books that he has been writing. And also, we'll be talking about the books that he's edited as well. Keith has also written novels for the Marvel Universe, the Buffy franchise, CSI New York, and StarCraft Ghost. In fact, he'll be returning to the world of StarCraft later this year in a manga series from Tokyo Pop. All that and more in a very interesting, nerd-like, inside baseball conversation here on Word Balloon. The conversation begins with our talk about Farscape.
With tie-in work, generally you're only going to get about 10% or less of the audience to pick up tie-in work. But how much of a percentage will vary? Because, like, for example, when both shows were on the air, there were Buffy the Vampire Slayer novels and there were Angel novels. Angel actually had a slightly bigger audience. Its ratings were always a couple points higher than Buffy. But okay. Buffy books sold better because even though Angel's audience was bigger, the Buffy had a much more dedicated, hardcore fan base that would be willing to go out and buy, ancillary merchandise.
Like, interesting. Okay.
They both did well. It wasn't like, but there are some shows that have never been able to take off in tie-ins for whatever reason,
sure. Even
they're very popular. The CSI novels do really well, but nobody's been able to make Law and Order novels work.
Now that's very interesting. I haven't noticed any Law and Order product. I have
there
talked
was, like,
to
one.
Wow.
Meanwhile, Pocket's been doing very well with CSI. So
Oh, I know. Max Collins has been on before. We've talked about that, and I know he's written both the comic book and the novels. And that's this is going to be fun to talk to you, and our conversation is going to go beyond what you're doing for Boom, but I do want to talk about all the tie-in stuff because really all you have to do is go to Keith's website and you'll find Buffy books there. You'll find a lot of Star Trek books there. I mean, this is, for that matter,
a CSI New York book.
And a CSI New York book, so there you go. So, I mean, I am curious about that. Compare this Farscape assignment to some of the others in terms of, how much Rockne is going over the material and really his hand in what's happening here in Farscape.
Well, as far as the main series is going, it's a collaboration. I mean, it's a straight up. He comes up with the story, which is a fairly detailed document. has an issue by issue breakdown of what happens in each issue. Then I take it and I break it down a little more heavily into what happens on each page, which is more for my own benefit, really, just to get ready for the script. And then I write the script.
Okay.
But we work very closely together on it. He doesn't just write the plot and go away. Every time I write a script, I send it to him first, and then he calls me, and we spend, 2 hours on the phone going over it. Usually it's only really 1 hour of actually going over the story and another hour of multiple digressions, bad puns, and various other things. What helps is that Rockne and I were already friends before we started working together. We first met back in 2001, I wrote a Farscape novel called House of Cards. And the Jim Henson Company threw a publication party for the book, and they flew in Rockne for it. And so we met for the first time there, and he really loved the book, which was very gratifying. And we stayed in touch after that. So when this came around, it was a perfect fit because, he knew my work, he knew me. He trusted me to handle the script, and I was very much looking forward to writing in the universe again. I did not only the novel, I did three short stories also.
Oh, that's terrific! That's really cool.
So it's worked out beautifully, and Rockne's just fun to work with. We're both very much on the same wavelength, which is something that should scare him more than it does me. And we both have fairly twisted sensibilities and similar ideas as to where to go with this. So we're having a great time, and I've collaborated with a bunch of different people in the past, and each one is different, but this one has been particularly enjoyable. And, we, you know, it's going to be continuing for the foreseeable future. So
that's great, because I really think, based on the two issues that I've read so far, I haven't read issue three yet, but it has the language of the show. The characterization is there that you're expecting. There are nods to previous episodes. I mean, it's everything you want in a tie-in property. It's the same kind of things that make the Buffy series good for Dark Horse and the better tie-in series. And, you know, I'm in my 40s, so I remember when comic book tie-ins were not the greatest things in the world. And, I mean, you really would get varying degrees. I mean, sometimes there'd be something cool from an art standpoint, or you might get that occasional Gold Key Star Trek that was pretty good. But it was pretty, I'll be honest, man, yeah, that's a needle in a haystack. I won't deny it. Yeah. And, you know, the covers were always cool.
It scares me that you're holding up Gold Key Star Trek as a paragon of good comic.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's bad. No, I'm saying, you know, you'd find that one as an 8-year-old, you kind of appreciate it. But yeah.
My favorite thing in the Gold Key was the colorist not realizing that Yeoman Rand's hair was her hair and colored it red because they thought it was a wool hat she was wearing.
Nice. It's crazy, though, because now, I mean, we are getting good product. And how many of the Farscape fans have contacted you and said, oh, you know, yeah, I read your novels, I read your short story and everything, and we're happy to see that you were back on the piece.
A lot of people were, because my novel was fairly well received when it came out. So, I mean, people were already confident. Rockne's involvement was announced first. That was announced at San Diego in 08. And so everybody was very happy to see that, because it had the same creator's imprimatur that the Buffy and Angel post-finale comics have.
Definitely,
You know, which is something that'll bring more people in. You know, if they know that the creator's involved with it, then it gives them a better feeling about what to expect. And then my involvement was announced later, and people were also pleased about that. And just generally, the response has been excellent. What's been particularly interesting, and this is something that the guys at Boom Studios have noticed, and I've seen it also, is the Farscape comic is bringing people into comic stores who don't normally go. I think one of the reasons why they've been selling so well is the books aren't just attractive to comics fans, but there are people who are going to the comic store for the express purpose of getting the Farscape comic.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. That's awesome.
Yeah. But it was still, I mean, now, you know, we can see how well it's doing and have adjusted accordingly. But when we first started, it was a real risk because nobody knew what to expect, partly because the show had been off the air so long.
How much time between Farscape 1 and the Peacekeeper Wars?
Peacekeeper Wars was 04, I think.
Wow, I had no idea it was that long ago. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the show ran until, yeah, it was 04, because the show ran from 99 to 03, four seasons, and then the Peacekeeper Wars was about a year later. So, yeah, it was in 2004, so it was a good 4 year, you know, four, almost 5 years between them. And that's a long time. You know, people move on and do other things, you know. So there was a risk that, you know, the fan base would have moved on to different things in the 5 years since. So, but it turns out they're still out there and still enjoying the show, and they still miss it, and they're glad to see it back. So,
well, and
I'm thrilled.
I really have enjoyed the first two issues. It does pick up where the Peacekeeper Wars end. It doesn't seem like it's 4 years down the line story wise, and that's great. And
that was on purpose, you know. Since we're not beholden to the actors aging, you know,
sure.
Which you know, I mean, if they tried to bring it back on TV now, you'd have to account for the fact that all the actors are 4 or 5 years older, particularly, you know, Ben Browder and Claudia Black. You know, the others are enough covered in makeup that you could fake it probably. but even so, you know, that would need to be accounted for when you're dealing with actual people who age. But in a comic book, you know, who cares? So. Since we could pick right up and just treat it as if it were, you know, a virtual season 5, why not? You know.
Well, and the story is great, and I don't want to spoil, but it's a natural progression of where everyone left off at the end of the Peacekeeper Wars, and I think it shows that there are still new stories to tell with these characters.
Yep. And also, the story in particular that we're doing in the first miniseries is something that really couldn't be done on the TV show. Simply because of budget and logistical restrictions. The story involves them going to Hyneria so Rigel can finally try to get his throne back.
Right.
And the the practicality of doing that on TV was such that they really couldn't.
There was a lot of Muppets.
And well, there was one episode in the third season where they had two Hymerians.
Yes.
There was a female Hymerian, Orn, who came on the ship. And apparently just having two of them was a logistical nightmare from which they still break out in hives at the mere mention of it at the creature shop. and so there was doing an entire planet of Hymerians was never going to happen. There was just no way on a TV show budget they could do that. You know, with a TV show budget and TV show time constraints.
Oh, definitely.
It just wasn't feasible. So it's the perfect thing to do for the first comic book miniseries because it gives us a chance to take advantage of the medium's unlimited budget for all intents and purposes and, you know, really do something unique for the medium. You know, one of the things I particularly loved about the Buffy post-finale comic was having Dawn as a giant.
Sure.
Because that was something they never would have been able to pull off on television at all, but in comic books you can do it, and it's convincing, and it won't look stupid. And, you know, same thing here. The first, right out of the gate, we're trying to do something that embraces the comics medium fully, not just being, you know, just an episode that happens to be in comic form, but something that, you know, can really take advantage of the medium.
Well, were there any design ideas for creatures or anything that were left on the draft board that Rockne may be bringing here to the comic book?
If there are, nobody's told me about them.
Okay.
I think they pretty much – usually what happened was the Henson shop would come up, I think, and somebody who actually worked on the show would know better than me, but I think a lot of times what would happen is the Henson people would have a design, and then they'd write an episode for it. I don't think there was anything – left. I could be wrong about that.
Okay.
I honestly don't know.
Well, I just kind of like the image of, you know, what do you think of this? All right,
yeah.
No problem, man. I'll write a story in 2 hours for you. Hold on a second.
Hey, they did that. Hey, they did it on the old Star Trek, you know. I mean, they created the Horta and they wrote, you know, here, look, we got a thing that looks like a pan pizza. Let's make a TV show around it.
Is that true? Is that really how it happened?
I believe so, yeah.
That's awesome.
I think that the Horta started out as a prop, I think. I'm now, of course, I'm like doubting my capacity for useless trivia here.
I'm sure
you'll get tons of emails from people who will correct me and say that I'm an idiot and all that other usual stuff.
No, it's cool. And really, I do want to talk about the Star Trek stuff in particular that you've written because, again, you're continuing the stories where they left off, and I think that's really interesting. As a writer, I understand that every comic book writer essentially does the same thing when they're not doing movie tie-ins. I mean, these are pre-existing characters. But is there any type of different vibe for you in terms of, you know, doing it as a comic, I understand that from a structural standpoint, the stories probably have to get chopped differently, but you tell me the differences in terms of adapting for a novel and adapting for a comic book.
Well, comic books are closer to the original form than novels are because you're still dealing with visuals and you're depending on the visuals to do a lot of the storytelling that the words have to carry by themselves in prose. In particular, the difference when you're writing prose is that you can get inside the characters' heads to a degree you can't really do on screen, and which you can only do to a much more limited extent in comic books. So that's the major difference right there. And also,
sure,
the story, you have to tell a much smaller, more compact story in a comic book simply because you only have 22 pages as opposed to an unlimited amount of prose. So also, at least when I'm creating a comic book, I almost think of each page as a discrete storytelling entity in a lot of ways.
Okay.
You know, and I try to have scenes start at the top of a page and finish at the end of a page. In reality, that doesn't always work. but I try to do that just because I think it makes the reading experience work better.
No, I think, and I'll say this as well, I think that your story beats feel like episodes. So I think when each issue ends, you know, a lot of people, you know the phrase, writing for the trade. I don't think that's happening here. I mean, you really are giving good cliffhangers at the end of each issue. And, as you say, I would, if not page by page, certainly scene by scene, feels natural.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
Yeah, and I was, well, I mean, I think Rockne was treating this as writing a four-act script in a lot of ways anyway in terms of how the story beats are set up, and that's more him than me.
Okay.
But also, yeah, I try, I I've always believed in the maxim that every comic is somebody's first. So, you know, I try to make each one as complete a storytelling experience as possible. I mean, it is going to be a 4-issue miniseries, and you know, if somebody comes in on the third issue, they might be just a little bit confused, but. But I try to fill them in as much as I can.
Well, I think the second issue did a good job of setting up what happened in the previous issue. So, I mean, no, I could see that. And again, good news, it's going back to press, so you can check out issue one as it comes out. Hearing that it's 4 issues, that's cool. Okay, because, again, I think the story is cooking along after 2 issues, and I think it's gotten to an interesting place. But
it'll come to an end after the 4th issue, and then we're going to start a second miniseries called Strange Detractors. Which will be the next story. You know, we're treating these as 4-issue. You know, it's going to be a series of 4-issue miniseries.
Okay.
I mean, in terms of the schedule, it's going to be a monthly comic. But
the stories are broken out into 4-chapter stories. That's cool.
Exactly.
Well, now, in addition to the second arc, it was announced at WonderCon that you're working on a Rigel, or not a, a Dargo miniseries. Excuse me.
Yes. Yeah. Called Dargo's Lament. That'll be a third season story featuring Dargo and Jewel, where right after Dargo got the old Luxon ship that he had salvaged working, the ship that he eventually named after his wife, he promised Jewel the first ride in the ship. This is going to be that first ride.
Oh, that's cool.
And they have to track down a substance that Moya needs, and they have a little trouble finding it, and much wackiness ensues, because if much wackiness didn't ensue, you wouldn't really want to read a story about it. So.
And back to the first arc that's in progress, you know, just to let people know who's in there, if you haven't picked this up yet, it's Crichton, it's Aaron, Dargo, Pilot is there.
No, Dargo isn't in it.
I'm sorry, not Dargo. I keep confusing Dargo and
Joffe,
Rigel.
His son. Yeah.
And well, actually, Rigel, because I was going to. You're right. Certainly, Joffe is with the crew now instead. Chiana is there. Like I said, Rigel is there. Big part of the, obviously the story. And
right. And Naranthi's still around too.
Oh, that's thank you. I can never remember Naranthi's name. Yes, the third eye blind woman, of course. That is.
Yes.
and others pop up as the story progresses, and we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and of course, Pilot's still there because you can't have him without Moya.
So. Yeah, there you go. And no, I think it's really cool, and everyone is speaking in their proper voice. I think it's great. I really do. I think that there are some very funny scenes in it and good action. And it really does feel like a fifth season, so I think that's great. And if you haven't seen it yet, I encourage you to get your shop to start ordering the book because, as I say, 2 issues in, it feels fantastic, and looking forward to more.
Me too.
So yeah, no, that's great.
I'm actually
man.
Almost done. At this point, I've scripted the 3 of the 4 issues of Strange Detractors, which is the second miniseries.
Cool.
We've got the plot set for the third miniseries, and I'm also finishing off. I've got one more issue of Dargo's Lament to write, and then we're talking about doing another more stuff beyond that, which
okay.
I can't talk about yet.
Okay. Maybe another.
I can't
character.
Talk about it until. Either, I can't talk about it until it's either in previews or boom, but it's sort of the press release.
That's fair. No problem. Well, and there's, again, with Dargo's Lament coming up and the second arc as well, so there's a lot to look forward to as things progress, so that's very cool, man.
Yep.
I am curious about the Star Trek stuff because you wrote Q&A, which is a Next Generation book.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, I mean, it's post.
No, not technically, it's a Next Generation.
Okay, I wasn't sure. I was going to say it's post Nemesis. So yeah, I mean, I know you know part of the crew is there, and you know their part isn't or whatever.
Yeah.
People who are on the Titan now.
So, yeah, or know. Dead.
Or dead, exactly. Yes. And then also you wrote a Klingon book as well. I want to ask about the Klingon book first, just because it's about the Gorkon ship returning to the Klingon Empire. Was that
right.
All right? Now I'm going to totally nerd out and be. Total Next Generation mode. If I haven't already, duh. But just showing what
Dude,
I know
you do
about
a comic book podcast. You're
yeah,
already
yeah,
nerd
yeah,
out.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Run with it.
I'm sorry. I should have checked on the name on my underwear this morning. Exactly. You know, silly me. But regarding this is the Gorkon ship. Now, is that from the first or second season? Is that like that old Klingon ship that?
No. The Gorkon's a ship I created. I actually had done 3 prior books with that crew. Actually. 4 or 5 prior books with that crew.
Oh, man, okay.
Yeah, so the I first showed them in a Next Gen novel I did back in 2001 called Diplomatic Implausibility, which was a story featuring Worf's first mission as an ambassador after Deep Space Nine ended.
Okay.
And
that's very cool.
And then I did, they showed up in another crossover series I did, a two-book series called The Brave and the Bold, which was showing my comic book geek roots there. It was the theme of that was teaming up each of the crews of the shows with the crew of another ship. So, and in the case of the Enterprise E, it was them teaming up with the Gorkon crew. I also put together Kirk's Enterprise together with Matt Decker and the Constellation about a year prior to the Doomsday Machine.
Oh, that's really cool. Okay.
Yeah, that was fun. That was actually how that story got started, was I wanted... Matt Decker was a character who I thought really fascinated me, and I wanted to do more with him. And it was obvious he and Kirk knew each other in the Doomsday Machine. So, what I postulated was the idea of an adventure that was about a year previous, in which they first met and had to work together. And then I did the DS9 crew with the crew of the Odyssey, which was the Galaxy-class ship that got blown up when they introduced the Jem'Hadar.
Absolutely, yes.
Voyager, I did a little weird one because I did a story that actually predated the first episode. So it was sort of a double team up of Voyager with the USS Hood and also Chakotay's Maquis cell with Cal Hudson's Maquis cell from Cal Hudson from DS9. And it actually told the story of how and why Tuvok infiltrated the Maquis in the first place.
Oh, that's really cool.
And then the last part was the Enterprise and the Gorkon, which then eventually led to doing an IKS Gorkon series, which only lasted the three books. And then we rebranded it as Klingon Empire last year. So that's where that all came from.
Okay, that's... Wow, okay. You see, and shame on me for
not... Much more complicated answer than I'm sure you were expecting.
No, this is great because this inspires a bunch of other questions. I agree with you, by the way, about Matt Decker, and I think William Wyndham was such a great character actor, and...
Oh, yeah.
I haven't seen him lately. Did you ever watch those, and I'm sure you did, those special edition Star Trek episodes that Sci-Fi Channel ran when they would, like, show the uncut episode? And
Yeah.
Well, and did you see William Wyndham talking about the Doomsday Machine and everything?
Yeah.
It's so funny because I agree. His characterization was so great. And now it's just like, I don't know. I did it 40 years ago. I've done a million things, and everybody wanted to talk about the Doomsday Machine. And he was just so awesomely crotchety about the whole thing. I thought that was fantastic. I was like, that's great, man. You know, it's kind of like Alec Guinness and Obi-Wan Kenobi. It's like, shut the fuck up, man. I don't care. It was too long ago. And I know he just murdered his name. Sorry, Star Wars fans. Deal with it.
Yeah.
Sometimes crap falls in our mouths and we can't help it. But no, I think I do remember seeing those books on the shelves, and now shame on me that I didn't pick them up because now they sound cool. And that's the thing. I think these pocketbooks, especially the Star Trek series, is great. I mean, there's so many great stories in there. And
yeah, what was particularly fun with the Gorkon books was to do kind of, the Klingon version of the Star Trek mission. You know, their mission is to seek out new life, new civilization, and conquer them for the greater glory of the Klingon Empire. You know, none of this namby-pamby Prime Directive shit, So that the first story I did was basically that. It was them, on a mission of exploration. It's right after the Dominion War, and the Klingon Empire needs to get back on its feet. So
that's excellent. Captain Clagg, I'm assuming, is your captain.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, he came from second season Next Gen episode, the one where Riker served on a Klingon ship, Matter of Honor.
Oh, is he the guy that's left the command after Riker leaves?
No, he wasn't the captain of the ship. He was the second officer that Riker became friends with.
Oh, I thought, for some reason, that's right, the captain does stay in his chair. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm hip. Okay. Very cool. I know who you're talking about.
And, Brian Thompson played him. And I liked the character. I thought he had, the whole backstory with him and his father. The mess hall scene in that episode is one of Next Gen's best moments, honestly. So I used him. The crew is populated with a bunch of other Klingons who showed up on various episodes of Next Gen and DS9, and then a few of my own creation as well. And it was really fun to just develop those characters pretty much, free reign. because even the ones that appeared on screen weren't ever likely to appear on screen again, so I could pretty much do whatever the hell I wanted with them. And I've also used Worf and Martok and some other Klingon characters that were established. So it was a lot of fun to do, those first three books. And then with Klingon Empire, we wanted to expand the focus a little bit beyond just one ship. So we used the ship as sort of a springboard to explore different parts of the Empire, not just... I mean, on the shows, we got a lot of the military and the politics. And that's a very important part of Klingon life, but it can't be all of it. You can't run an interstellar empire made up entirely of warriors. It wouldn't work. Somebody still has to build shit, and, you know, you still need farmers, you need doctors, you need, you know, service people. So, artists, for that matter. So I wanted to show different aspects of Klingon life, which still has a lot of the same personality, but not necessarily the same concerns. You know, like a farmer is going to be more concerned with, you know, getting the crops ready and putting food on the table than he or she is with, you know, fulfilling a sense of honor that really is a secondary concern for them, you know, when survival is more important, you know.
Well, and plus, again, another television budgetary nightmare to try and show the Klingon.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I totally remember seeing on message boards, what should Star Trek do next? And everyone's like, oh, focus on another planet. Do a Klingon show. Wouldn't that be great? And obviously we got teased with it a few times, with especially in Deep Space Nine, when you'd get the, you know, all Klingon episodes, it seems, or all the all Ferengi episodes. So,
but those are hellishly expensive to do.
Once again, yeah. Well, that's cool, and it's something you can explore now in the books. I really was, you know, interested in talking to you because of the Farscape stuff, and I said, oh, cool, he wrote Star Trek books. I'll be honest, there have been varying degrees of success as far as my as a reader, what I've read from the Star Trek books, and there are certain authors that I, you know, came to trust and felt like I got burned on some new names that I hadn't heard of. But your stories sound cool, man, and obviously they keep giving you the gigs, so they must love you.
Yes, yeah.
Well, that's good.
15 of them now, so...
How many?
About 15 novels.
Jesus, man, that's fantastic. That's excellent.
And a bunch. I also did a bunch of novella-length stories that were published as e-books and then later have been reprinted in print form.
These are the Starfleet Corps of Engineer stories?
Yes.
Excellent.
And I've done a few short stories for a bunch of the different anthologies that have come out. I also edited two of the anthologies as well.
Oh, no
and
kidding.
And I've also got a... Huh?
I had no idea. The Strange New Voyages?
No. Dean Wesley Smith edited those. No, I did. There were a bunch of anniversary anthologies that came out earlier this decade. DS9, the 10th anniversary of DS9 was in 2003. 10th anniversary of Voyager was in 2005. The 40th anniversary of the original series was 2006. And the 20th anniversary of Next Generation was 2007. And each of those were commemorated with a short story anthology.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
And I had stories in three of them. I didn't do one for the original series one, but I did ones for the DS9 Voyager and TNG ones. And I also edited two anthologies called Tales of the Dominion War and Tales from the Captain's Table.
Oh, that's cool. I enjoyed both of those. I remember the Dominion Wars book, and I remember the Captain's Table book.
Yeah.
Very cool, man.
And the Dominion War was particularly fun, and that was a very successful anthology, too. It you know, looked at... I mean, DS9 showed the Dominion War in much the same way that MASH showed the Korean War. It was the war through the lens of one particular location, you know?
Absolutely.
So what I wanted to do with the anthology was to show what everybody else was doing, you know? There are a couple of Enterprise stories. There was actually a couple of Deep Space Nine stories in there. There's a story involving, you know, what Spock was doing on Romulus, what some of the novel... there's a bunch of prose-only series, not just, you know, the Gorkon books that I was doing, but also Peter David's New Frontier series, you know, what those guys were doing. What
sure.
There's a Starfleet Corps of Engineers story in there. And for that matter, Dave Mack did a really nice story that laid the groundwork for Nemesis, showing what, because it was established in the movie that Shinzon served in the Romulan military during the Dominion War, so we see one of his missions. You know, just generally showing the broader campus of the Dominion War is a lot of fun to put together.
Absolutely.
And, my story for that is one I'm particularly proud of. It was the fall of Beta Zed, which was mentioned on a Deep Space Nine episode, and I actually dramatized it through the eyes of Luxana Troi.
Oh, that's great! Wow, yeah. Very cool, man.
That was. I refer to that as my 9/11 catharsis story. I live in New York City, and I was, you know, here during September 11th.
Sure.
And that experience informed a lot of the writing of that particular story.
Wow.
And it was. I won't go so far as to say it was fun to write, but I'm very pleased with how the story came out. It also dealt with, you know, some issues of telepathy, which is something that's always fascinated me, going back to my days as a teenager reading X-Men comics and Alfred Bester's novels. So,
what iteration of Star Trek do you enjoy writing for the most? Is there one of the different, you know, universes that
probably the ones I enjoy writing the most are the ones I was involved in creating, which would be the Gorkon series,
sure.
You know, that crew, and also the USS Da Vinci crew for the Starfleet Corps of Engineers series.
Very cool.
I was the editor of that series. I helped develop it. I wrote the second ebook, and I wrote a bunch more ebooks in addition to editing it. I was, you know, it was a monthly ebook series, so it was a new story every month. It lasted from 2000 until 2007.
I enjoyed many of the books, man. I didn't read them as e-stories, but I did read the collections
right.
when they would come out, and they were great.
They're still coming out, so...
Well, there you go.
One just came out called Wounds,
okay.
Which has one of... That has a bunch of crossovers with Deep Space Nine, actually. There's a story called Malefactorum by Terry Osborne, which has Kira and Quark and a couple of others. And then Ilsa Bick did two stories in there, the title story Wounds and another one called Lost Time, which cross over with some of the characters.
What time period is the Corps of Engineers stories? I mean,
right after the Dominion War. The stories are about the first year and a half or so up to when the series came to an end. Because that was the time frame we were working in when the series started in 2000.
Are they tied in with the Deep Space Nine post?
Yes. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
everything is unified as far as the pocketbooks
yep.
go. As far as, you know, if it's post Nemesis or whatever, I suppose. As far as
on pretty much anything post DS9, more or less.
What about the new? What about the new movie, Keith? Are you going to be involved with any? You know,
At the moment, I know. I know as much about the new movie as anybody else does. The security of this thing has been tight as a drum.
Sure.
And I don't know, and I don't think anybody else knows. What effect it's going to have on the future of the tie-in line. A lot will depend on, you know, how well it does.
Certainly.
And Pocket can afford to take it slow with it to see, you know, how it does, because they've already got a very firmly established line that really probably, at least one way or the other, won't be all that much affected by this movie in either direction. So they can wait and see how the movie does, see how successful it is, see where they want to go forward with it, and then work with... you know, Paramount and Bad Robot, and take it from there. So, but I think they're taking a wait and see attitude. Yeah, you know, I mean, there's going to be a novelization of the film, which is
sure.
written by Alan Dean Foster.
And I know IDW is cranking out.
And yeah, and they've got Countdown, which I really need to catch up with.
Me too, actually, man. Do you?
It's hilarious. Here I am finally writing comics, and I haven't had time to read them.
Have you read any of the? Stuff IDW has been doing with Star Trek. John Byrne's stuff has been pretty
cool. Oh, yeah. No, in fact, I'm writing one.
Which one are you writing, man?
I wrote, surprise, a Klingon Alien Spotlight. It'll be out in April.
Oh, fantastic, man. Very cool.
That was fun, and I'd like to do more with IDW. It just it hasn't happened yet, but and it may not happen. I'm hoping to do more with them. I think how well the Klingon story does will have an impact on that to some extent.
Tell us about
that
story.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, tell us.
I got to work with J.K. Woodward, which was
great.
A joy and a half.
Yeah.
He is really just an amazing artist. And the story I came up with is actually, I decided to make it hard on myself. I only had 22 pages to tell a story, so I made it harder on myself by making it three different stories. So it's really three 7-page stories. One of them has, and you know, one story has a double page spread. So
awesome. What time period are we looking at?
Several, actually. It's Kang, Michael Ancera's character.
Excellent.
Telling three different stories at three different times in his life. And the, for lack of a better word, moral of each story is the phrase, 4,000 throats may be cut in a single night by a running man.
Which was in Blood Oath, I believe, correct?
No, that was from Day of the Dove, actually.
Okay.
Kang's appearance on the original series.
That's awesome.
Spoken by one of his lieutenants. And so I've got Kang in the 23rd century when he's, you know, on his ship And he's telling his crew a story from when he was a younger officer. And then the middle story takes place in the early part of the 24th century. Excuse me. And Kang is telling his wife about a recent encounter he had on his ship. That story will also have the Enterprise B in it, so I got to work in John Harriman and Damaris Sulu just for fun.
Very cool.
And then the last story takes place around the time of shortly before Blood Oath, which is Kang caring for the albino's wife, the one who gave him the information on where to find him.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells her a story, an ancient Klingon legend from, you know, Kalis's time.
Sure.
Of this warrior who killed 4,000 knights in a single night. So, and J.K. took it one step further. Each story is told, he does each story in a different art style.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
That's great. Did Aunt Sarah pass away?
No, he's still alive.
Okay, I was just wondering, because, yeah, when he would pop up on shows like, you know, Deep Space Nine and Babylon 5, yeah. I'm like, oh, my God, he's still around. That's great. I was happy to see him.
Amusingly, in Blood Oath, they killed Kang and Koloth, but Kor stayed alive. Of the three actors, John Colicos, who played Kor, is the only one who's dead.
Oh, that sucks. Oh, man. Yeah. Well, you can always, you know, it's time for another
Captain. And they killed him off later. So.
I was going to say.
Killed off later.
It's time for another Captain Sulu story. So, you know.
Yeah.
That's right. You're right. Kor, yeah, and I forgot. That's right. Kor goes into the suicide mission on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool.
Kor is fun to write. I have gotten to write both Kor and Kang on several different occasions. And, in fact, I've got coming in 2010, there's going to be an anthology called Seven Deadly Sins, which is going to be a Klingon story that takes place during the 23rd century, and it's going to involve Kor Kang and Koloth when they were young men.
That's cool.
Contemporaneous with the original series.
Certainly. Oh, no, and
The anthology is going to be very cool. It's going to be seven novella-length stories, each focusing on a particular species that represents a deadly sin. The Klingons, obviously, are going to be anger. Let's see, the Cardassians are envy, the Romulans are pride, the Pakleds are sloth, the Ferengi are greed, the Borg are gluttony,
okay.
And lust is going to be the mirror universe.
Very cool. Oh, that's great, man. See, that's excellent. I really do. In general, I've read the pocketbooks for years, and I got to be honest, some of them lately were just like, I don't know if I'm, you know, interested in dipping in. But I think, honestly, you've teased some interesting things that I'll be spending $7.99 for some new paperbacks, I guess. Because, it's good to hear. Because that's the thing.
Well, you mentioned Q&A when we first started talking about this. One of my contributions to the 20th anniversary of Next Gen in 2007. And when I was first approached with the idea of doing it, what I wanted to do was the ultimate Q story. Something that would really explain what Q had been up to all this time, because the idea had sort of been percolating in the back of my head for a while, and I thought, you know, since Next Gen started with Q and ended with Q, that there needed to be something done with Q for the anniversary. So, I did a story that basically tied all of his other appearances together, and it was so much fun to write. Q. Of all the characters in Star Trek, Q is in many ways the most fun because he can pretty much say whatever the fuck he wants.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, and in the right hands of the right writer and everything, you're right. No, you know, I think Picard's greatest. That's his Luther.
One of the things they learned early on in the show, and one of the former Star Trek editors, John Ordover, always told writers who were doing Q stories to make sure of this, the best Q is at his best when you put him in a room with Picard. You know, the two of them bouncing off each other is gold. You know, and Q was always more effective when he was, you know, trading barbs with Picard. So I tried to make sure the two of them were together as much as possible.
That's really cool. That's great, man. No, I think you've described him to a T, and it always surprised me that they never made a film with John DeLancey because.
Yeah,
he was magic, and I not to shit on it, but I got to be honest. His appearances on Voyager kind of diminished him, I thought, because
there were two problems with him appearing on Voyager. One was he didn't have Patrick Stewart to play off of, and
yep.
Q really was more effective, you know.
Yes,
and also by putting him on Voyager, it immediately raised the question of why didn't he just snap his fingers and send them home? You know.
Yeah.
I mean, he could. I mean, obviously he didn't, and he could. It would have been perfectly in character for him to not do it just because he's a son of a bitch. But it still, like, it put the elephant in the room, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, that show in general, and it makes me wonder why Stargate is going to the Voyager kind of model, and it's like, what are you doing? I just think because that concept can only last a couple years.
The thing is, I can't. Part of the problem Voyager had was they didn't really embrace that premise at all.
Right.
You know, they're stuck many miles from home, and yet their uniforms are always pressed, and they always have plenty of food, and their shuttles keep magically being rebuilt. You know, and any damage they suffer is conveniently fixed by the next week. You know, if the writers of Stargate Universe actually, you know, deal with all the issues that would come up in the same way that, say, the first season of Battlestar Galactica did.
Even the way it's ending now. I mean, it's the same thing. But go ahead.
Yeah. But you know, actually, you know, dealing with the consequences, you know, what it really means to be that far away from home, which Voyager never did. You know, they never really and it was frustrating because that was what the series was sold on, and then they didn't really run with it to the extent that they could have.
Absolutely.
I always found that really disappointing. It's also been tough. One of the hard things with Voyager is what do you do with it? How do you do a post-finale Voyager novel that's really effective because the show is over? The whole show was about getting home, and it ended with them getting home.
Okay, can I give you my free pitch of how they screwed up Voyager? Honestly, I was hoping in the middle of the last season, regardless, yeah. I'm going to do it, obviously. No, but
I don't care.
Well, I know. But I thought they should have reached Earth in the middle of the last season and gotten the, hey, welcome home for the Federation, and then you turn to Chakotay, you're under arrest, B'Elanna, you're under arrest, take the Borg for an autopsy, and Janeway, you're going to have to explain to a tribunal why you embraced this mutinous, you know, Maquis crew and suddenly absorbed them,
right,
rather
yeah.
than keeping them in the brig for the last 7 years. And that would have been an, oh, shit, this is going to be a fun, in the same way that Deep Space Nine was this great last 10-chapter story.
Although I honestly thought that Deep Space Nine should have had the end of the war during February sweeps and then done the aftermath of it, because DS9, there was only, I love DS9, it's my favorite of the five
Me
shows.
Too, man. Go ahead.
But they blew one very important thing. Sisko's mission when he took the assignment in the first episode was to get Bajor ready to join the Federation. The series should not have ended with the end of the war. The series should have ended with Bajor joining the Federation.
That's a good point. I respect that.
The good thing, of course, is that we got to do it in the books.
Yeah, that's true. Those books were fantastic. I really enjoyed that series very much.
Well, it's still going on.
I guess once Sisko came back, I think that's when I kind of closed the book on it. I haven't read anything since. So I think,
okay. There've been
go ahead, Shane.
There've been 3, 6, 9, a bunch. There've been a bunch of books.
That's okay. If you know the number, it's cool. Say it. It's all right. But
no,
I
don't remember off the top of my head. there were also, it's confusing because the initial books after Unity, which was the one that brought Sisko back and put Major in the Federation.
J.M. Dillard, I believe, wrote that book.
No, S. C. Perry.
All right, I suck. All right, S. C. Perry, who wrote most of the other fine. I think.
Oh, she's done a bunch of the novelizations, and she did a couple of Enterprise novels.
Very cool.
And she also wrote Resistance, one of the next gen novel, right just before Q&A.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, but S.D. Perry wrote that. S.D. Perry wrote Avatar, which was the two part beginning of the post finale story.
Yes, of course.
Unity.
Okay.
And also did Rising Sun, which was the Jake story.
Very cool. Remember both? I remember all three.
But anyway, after Unity, there were three books that were actually six novels. Which is why the number gets confusing. Each paperback had two short novels in them, and it was called Worlds of Deep Space Nine, where each novel focused on a particular world that was important to one of the characters. So you had, you know, Cardassia, Bajor, the Dominion, and I did Ferenginar.
Okay.
Which was so much fun. I mean, I've gained a reputation as the Klingon guy because I've done so many Klingon-focused things.
Okay.
You know, besides the Gorkon series and a bunch of other novels, I did a novel called The Art of the Impossible, which was all about a conflict, an 18-year conflict between the Cardassians and the Klingons. And so in an attempt to sort of not typecast myself, I lobbied to do the Ferengi novel because you can't get more opposite from the Klingons than the Ferengi.
Absolutely. Very cool.
And it was fun. You know, the Ferengi can be a lot of fun to write when, particularly, the character of Quark. Armin Shimerman did such a wonderful job with him. It's just wonderful to see them lines, you know.
I enjoyed his novel that he wrote or co-wrote a few years ago. I thought he wrote a really good Ferengi novel. So, yeah. No, and you're right. And much like the Klingon episodes, I think the Ferengi episodes were among the best on DS9 as well. So I can see that. That's really cool, Keith. This is eye-opening for a guy who really thought of himself as a Star Trek fan, and I hadn't read so many of the newer paperbacks. So I really appreciate this, and I'm guessing that there might be other listeners that might be going to the bookstore as well and checking some of this stuff out. That's really cool, man.
I can use the royalty money.
Well, it's there. You go. Here. And also, it's fun to hear another Star Trek writer talk about this. I had the pleasure of talking to Peter David at one of the Wizard shows about his involvement in it. But really, I guess you're the second writer that I've been able to talk to about the books. So the Cardassian War and some of the Cardassians and the Klingons. I'm curious too about that first Cardassian War. Was that ever explored in the novels?
Not yet.
Okay.
There was talk about doing one, but the editor who was talking about doing it got laid off last December. Thanks to our lovely new economic climate.
Woof.
So a lot of the plan, and it had nothing to do with him or his work or the quality of his work. They simply,
economics.
Chose 35 people to lay off and laid them off,
sure.
Regardless of how much good they were doing the company or not. And Marco Palmieri was the editor responsible for most of the Star Trek fiction, for about half of the Star Trek fiction.
I remember
and
that,
so
man,
all
absolutely.
Been dumped, it's now all been dumped on Margaret Clark. So, Margaret had her own stuff that she was responsible for, and now suddenly she's got everything else. So a lot of the plans for the line are in a bit of flux for that reason.
I see.
Simply because... Not only did Margaret have half the line dumped on her, she had half the line dumped on her with no notice.
Wow. Well, I can just imagine from an editing wrangling writer standpoint how crazy that must be.
The thing is, there have been a bunch of books that have dealt with Cardassia's history in other senses. There was a three-part story last year called Terok Nor, which chronicles the history of the Cardassian occupation of Bajor.
Okay.
And then there was the novel I referred to, The Art of the Impossible, which dealt with an incident that lasted 18 years. It was mentioned. This is some of the fun thing of writing tie-in fiction. You can take, the weird side things that they mention in passing and flesh them out.
Absolutely.
I took a 30-second conversation between Bashir and Garak from The Way of the Warrior, which is the fourth season premiere that brought Worf in.
Yep.
Where they talk about the Batrika Nebula incident. Now, all we know about this is what it was called, that it was between the Cardassians and the Klingons. It was ages ago, according to Garak, which could be anything, and peculiarly for an incident that lasted 18 years. Armed only with that, I crafted a 100,000-word novel.
That's great, man.
Which was... I'm particularly proud of that book. I think it's actually the strongest book I've written. Came out in 2003.
Very cool.
It was part of a series of books that were done under the umbrella title of The Lost Era, which were stories that took place between the end of the original series movies and the beginning of Next Generation.
Wow.
Which is like, there's about 70 years of story time there.
And there's the Cardassian War, and there's, I can understand that.
I mean, we didn't actually do the Cardassian War there, but we did do, this conflict, and there was there's an Excelsior story in there, there's an Enterprise B story in there.
Sure.
There's an Enterprise C story in there, and...
Oh, wow, that's cool.
And a couple of other, and then, three other books that are not as easily pigeonholed, but, one involving Riker at the Academy, and some others. It was a lot of fun.
Well, that's what I mean. When you can do, as you say, innocuous like lines like that, and fill in the gaps with some great stories, that's the reason why the franchise has lasted as long as it has. I'm sorry.
You hope they're good stories.
Well, yeah, obviously. But
we do our best.
That's cool. No, but that's really cool, man, and that's why it was interesting to read when Peter David came out with New Frontier, and it was interesting to see the Starfleet, the Corps of
Engineers. That was a huge, Corps of Engineers. It's funny, you know, now it's old hat, but in 1997, New Frontier was a huge risk.
I could see that.
Because nobody had ever done it, you know. I mean, it wasn't... One of the reasons why they were confident with it was that when DS9 came on the air in 93, it really changed what Star Trek was. Because up until that point, Star Trek was always, these are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. It could have been any number of different Enterprises, but it was always the Enterprise. Once DS9 started, the dam broke. And you could pretty, you know, Star Trek really was anything that took place in this universe. So, but it was still a risk, because nobody, like I said, nobody had ever done a Star Trek novel that wasn't specifically based on one of the, at the time, four Star Trek shows.
Sure. I do remember those Klingon stories that aren't considered canon anymore. there was a trilogy of books way, way back. It was maybe 70s or early 80s, where it didn't, I mean, it maybe stemmed from Kirk's stories, but it seemed to be about something happening on a Klingon world. But I hear what you're saying, and I agree, and I can appreciate where it is a risk, but, you know, it's like the old album cover, 50 million Elvis fans can't be wrong. And, the same could be said Star Trek fans.
Once they published it and it was hugely successful, then obviously they kept doing it.
Sure.
And we were able to do other things like, you know, Titan and Vanguard and Stargazer, the Corps of Engineers, and so on. And those have all been, you know, successful to various and sundry degrees. But it's just nice to be able, and we've been able to do other really bizarro things, including one book that I was in that I wrote that I'm particularly pleased with called Articles of the Federation, which was basically a Star Trek version of The West Wing.
Oh, that's fun.
It chronicled a year in the life of the Federation president. It's the year right after Star Trek Nemesis.
Okay.
So, among other things that the president has to deal with is the fact that the Romulan Empire just fell apart.
That's really cool, man. All right.
And that I had so much fun writing that book. It was one of those books that was very successful with the people who read it. It was probably one of the most praised books I've written, but it didn't actually sell all that well because it was such an odd duck, you know. It was so far out of the mainstream. That, you know, because it didn't involve any of the main Starship crews. There were very few recognizable characters in it. You know, the only main character from any of the shows who really was in it was Spock, and his role was comparatively small.
Okay.
It was very unusual. It was very acclaimed, but not exactly a barn burner as far as sales.
Well, but again,
but I'm
still
quite pleased with it. I was glad I was given the opportunity to do something like that.
Well, you're going to make me go look it up on Amazon and hopefully find it if it's not sitting in a warehouse somewhere. I'll look for it at some of the used stores because, again, I think these are interesting ideas that, you know, mm-hmm. It's no different than, and it's one of the reasons why I do Word Balloon. It's no different than only, you know, reading a thumbnail in a previews catalog rather than give you guys a chance to really talk about some of these stories. And hopefully this will attract more of an audience because I think that's great. And at the very least, you're getting one reader that's going to pick up a bunch of books. So, damn, man, my bank account can only handle so much. You're going to break me. No, but honestly, these sound like cool stories, and it's good to hear that, you know, you wonder sometimes. Like you say, you know, the Articles of Federation book didn't work out. And what I was wondering, too, about that pre-Enterprise book, and was it the Dreadnought class? I mean, it's a ship design that I've only seen in, like, those books that would show you kind of the conceptual art before they decided on what the Enterprise would look like.
Oh, God, yeah, the Diane Carey's old books, Dreadnought and Battle Station.
There you go. Yes.
From many, many moons ago, yeah.
Yeah, well, there
you
go.
Those were still, you know, basically stories about Kirk's Enterprise.
Maybe it isn't Diane Carey's books, but it's ones with the globe, you know, it kind of had a globe for kind of the saucer section. And
Starfleet Year One.
There you go, yes.
Yeah, that was actually originally told as a serial novel where each month, the two books that came out that month, this is back when they were doing two books a month, would have the next chapter of the book.
I remember that now that you say that.
And
okay.
Then it all got collected into a single volume, and the plan was to do a series of those, Starfleet Year 2, Starfleet Year 3, but then they announced Enterprise, and that didn't happen anymore.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's what I was wondering in terms of, yeah, how early you can go where, you know, there's fertile story territory.
The thing is that that's always a risk. You always risk that something's going to come along on screen that chickens what you've been doing, and it happens all the time. I mean, but you know, it doesn't matter if the story's still good.
Absolutely.
One of the most, arguably the most popular Star Trek novel, certainly the one that regularly wins all those, you know, what do you think is the best Star Trek novel poll, is Federation by Judith and Garfield Reed Stevens. That story was kicked pretty thoroughly in the nuts of Star Trek continuity when First Contact came out.
Okay.
Because First Contact proposed, you know, a completely different 21st century than what Judy and Gar did. But people still love Federation, and for that matter, people still love First Contact.
I'll even include Strangers in the Sky, that time travel story novel that kind of postulated the first meeting of Vulcans and humans in a very different way from First Contact.
Yeah, exactly.
And another one too. Yesterday's Sun. I always thought that was a great story, and certainly not part of canon. But you know,
well, it could be. I mean, that one doesn't really. Yesterday, there's nothing that has happened on screen that has actively contradicted anything that happened in Yesterday's Sun.
Okay. All right.
You know, but and whether it does or not, you know, I really don't care to get arsed up over what's real in a fictional construct. You know,
no, I completely agree, man.
The canon arguments just make me break out in hives, because you know I just don't care that much. If it's a good story, it's a good story, you know. And if it doesn't fit, like you know, and the Federation First Contact example is, I think, you know, a particularly good one. For that matter, not to put too fine a point on it, but the movie The Dark Knight isn't canon.
That's right.
That is not the canon of the Batman story that DC Comics published. It was the most popular movie on the planet last year. I don't think people really cared that it wasn't part of the canon.
You are 100% correct.
And nobody's asking Christopher Nolan or Jon Favreau, for that matter, if they're concerned that their stuff isn't canonical, you know.
I completely
agree.
God
knows Hugh Jackman's Wolverine movie isn't going to be canonical, but I think people are going to go see it.
No, I think you're right, and I completely agree. Well, that leads me to ask a question. It bums me out because I do think the books would be a good opportunity, because it's not in canon, to do things like, let's see McCoy on his deathbed. Let's see some of the classic characters. And it's just a story. I mean, I kind of understand that you want to continue to write books and everything, but, does that ever come up? Does anyone ever pitch I know it hasn't been covered on screen, so... You know, can't we just do an alternate, you know, view of Lieutenant Kyle, you know, Commander Kyle's death? Somebody, if not the big three.
We've killed any number of people off. Actually,
who's died? Who's died in the books? Rattle off some people.
Well, probably the biggest one was Catherine Janeway.
That's true. Shame on me. Now you see. All right, that's a good question, because I did read Peter David's part of that
Before
book.
Dishonor. Yeah.
Yes, and I was wondering. Okay, that's an interesting thing, because certainly Kate Mulgrew is still around, so the opportunity for Admiral Janeway is, I guess, a possibility, theoretically.
Yeah, but it also doesn't look like they're going to be going back to the 24th century anytime soon. And if they do, then we'll deal with it, you know. the same way we dealt with it after First Contact came out, you know. A lot of the canon characters who've been killed are, you know, comparatively minor characters. To some extent or other.
Did you kill Lieutenant Riley?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. give me a list of names. Hey, you gotta go down the geek road before you explain why or why.
Yeah, let's see if I can dredge them all back up. Let's see. I've killed a bunch of Klingons off in my various novels. Klingons have appeared in various episodes.
Like?
But you know, that's their lifestyle. Cornyn, who was in Soldiers of the Empire.
Okay.
I didn't kill her off, but one of the other authors killed off Martok's wife, Sorella.
Bummer.
and for that matter, I killed off his son, Drek. So that was in a recent book I killed off.
Okay. Is Alexander... Alexander's got to still be around.
Alexander's not only still around, he is now the Federation ambassador to the Klingon Empire. He takes over from Worf after Worf goes back to Starfleet.
Oh, that's awesome.
That was something I did in one of my books. We did a 9-book series called... We called it the Attain Two series. All the books had different titles from the Book of Ecclesiastes.
Yes, okay, I remember seeing those books. Go ahead.
Yeah, Those nine books were the lead into Nemesis. That was basically setting Nemesis up.
Okay.
And I did the grand finale, which was called A Time for War, A Time for Peace. And one of my things was to, you know, explain how and why Worf rejoined Starfleet and Nemesis after his ambassadorial post. And one of the things he does is recommend Alexander to be his replacement. And when you pick up Articles of the Federation, you'll get to see him in action as, you know, Ambassador Rozhenko.
Oh, that's really cool.
So, yes. He's still around. Let's see. We've killed off. Now I'm forgetting who. Well, Amanda's been killed off a couple of times.
Okay. Spock's mom.
Yeah.
Okay.
At least one. Was it Sarek? No, Sarek killed off T'Pau.
Okay.
And I mean, we know Amanda died at some point.
Right, because so, of Parent.
You know, some of them are like original series characters where they just show them getting killed. Azit Bor, who was the Klingon Chancellor in Star Trek VI who took over from her father.
Oh, okay.
David George did her death. I actually dramatized, in The Art of the Impossible, the novel I mentioned before, I dramatized the Kittimer Massacre, which is when Worf's parents were killed.
Sure. Wow. Okay.
David R. George did McCoy's death in the Crucible trilogy that came out in 2006.
Oh, I had no idea. Oh, that's...
Yeah.
Wow.
I killed off Mr. Hum. What's on his valet?
Yeah.
In the Fall of Beta Zed story, I knocked him off.
Wow. Harsh, man.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Lots of people we've taken out here and there.
That's really well, and that's cool.
Ellie Graff took out Dr. Piper from Where No Man Has Gone Before.
Now, all right, now here we go. I gotta call you on a nerd with a nerd flag. I don't care. But did, like, anybody go, oh, I don't know, wait a minute, Mr. Hom was in Peter David's Imzadi whatever in the future, although I guess that was an alternate future.
It was an alternate future.
Nice. That's thank you, Perry Mason. Very good, man. That's awesome. No, honestly,
I got an answer for everything.
Well, but, seriously, man, I am so with you on who cares if it's canon or not, as long as it's a good story, tell it. That's
That's
the fun of the pocketbooks. And you're right. Who the hell cares?
And, you know, we do endeavor to be consistent with what we know. You know, sometimes things are going to get superseded. But, you know, the thing is, we're talking about Hollywood people, they are not going to change a story they want to do because of a book that was read by, you know, a tiny fraction of their audience.
Right, many thousand people, you know? But still certainly not a movie audience or potential movie audience.
Or a TV show audience, for that matter.
Absolutely.
You know, the lowest-rated episode of the lowest-rated of any of the five TV shows is still going to reach a number in the millions. And a novel is never going to even hit 1 million.
I understand.
You know?
I understand.
Or if it does, it's going to take many, many years to get that far.
You know, and you don't have to give specific numbers if you don't want to, but how big is the pocketbook Star Trek audience, say, versus whatever the mythical number is of the comic book reading audience? Is it about the same? Is it...
I'm not really sure exactly what the sales figures are, and the other problem is I don't know what the numbers are for comics these days, to be perfectly honest.
Okay, okay.
I think novels tend to reach more people than comic books, particularly once you get past, you know, the X-Men and Spider-Man and Avengers and
sure,
whatever events are going on.
Okay.
You know, once you get past the big stuff, I think it's a smaller number.
Okay.
Generally, but it varies. And I don't know enough about either comic sales or the book sales to really give a definitive answer to that. So.
Have you done Star Trek conventions?
Oh, tons.
Okay.
I do a lot of conventions over the course of a given year. Most of the cons I go to that's not even always true. A lot of them are kind of multimedia type conventions, like ICON out here in New York, which is a media, comics, and literary convention out on Long Island. I go to Shore Leave every year, which is a fan run media convention in the Baltimore area that's been particularly friendly to Star Trek writers.
That's cool.
Probably the largest concentration of Star Trek authors at any one convention is usually at Shore Leave. I always go to Dragon Con.
Okay.
And I've gone to Comic Con in San Diego many times. I might be going this year, but mostly because of the Farscape stuff.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's
I always go to New York Comic Con because it's right outside my door.
Well, that's cool. Well, it's funny.
You know, I love a big comics convention I can commute to.
Here, here.
There aren't nearly enough of those, unfortunately. And I do a lot of East Coast literary conventions. There's one coming up this weekend as we do this interview. It'll be over by the time the podcast airs. But a convention called Lunacon, which is held just outside New York City. One called Aresia up in Boston, PhilCon down in Philadelphia, you know, and a few others that I, BaltCon down in Baltimore, that I do sometimes.
Are you going to be doing any Chicago conventions?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
This year. It's funny, I'm actually trying to cut down, and yet I keep winding up going to things. I don't have any current plans to go to Chicago. The only non-coastal convention that I'm doing is a convention in Dallas called FenCon, which I'm a special guest at this year. So
very cool. What city? Oh, in Dallas. Excuse me.
Dallas. Yeah.
Very cool.
In Texas, which will be my first time in Texas in many, many years.
What month is that con?
That's in September.
Okay. Very cool.
And we're probably going to go up to Montreal for the World Science Fiction Convention this year, which is more an excuse to go to Montreal than it is actually wanting to go to the convention.
Because
we like Montreal.
Nothing wrong with Montreal. It's a beautiful city. I think that's great.
And the two biggest conventions, the two that I'm guaranteed to do no matter what are, well, three, because I always do New York Comic Con because it's local. We always do Shore Leave because it's like our home away from home.
Okay.
And
Baltimore's great.
And
Dragon
Con.
Dragon Con, sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
I love Dragon Con. It's much fun.
Did you do any of the Star Trek panels that were going on at WonderCon?
No, because at WonderCon I was spending every moment of every day at the Bloom Studios booth pimping the Farscape comic.
Very cool.
I was there on Boom's dime, so I was, my function there was to shill the Farscape comics, and I was happy to do that.
One, and again, it's a great product, and that's why,
I had no problem doing that, you know, and it was fun to do, and it was also nice to have, you know, a home base, but, it was fun, you know, hawking Boom's other stuff. Boom has a really good list of material, and I'm not just saying that because they hired me. I'm saying that because I've been reading it and really liking it. I'm not as much into the Cthulhu or the Warhammer stuff simply because it's just not my cuppa, as it were. But that stuff's really good, and they've done a bunch of other things that are just some really fine work.
No, I agree.
The Hero Squared comic.
Absolutely. Just had J.M. Demetatis on to talk about the Hero Squared stuff and what's going on over there. And,
oh, great! Yeah,
yeah.
I finally got to meet him. It's funny. I talked to him on the phone a lot way back in the '90s. I edited the Marvel Comics novels that came out that Berkeley Books published.
Oh, very cool!
Yeah, that was my baby.
Which heroes were covered in those books?
Spider-Man, the X-Men, Fantastic Four, the Hulk, Silver Surfer, the Avengers, Captain America, Iron Man.
Was there a Daredevil book, too?
There were a couple Daredevil books, yes.
Okay. I think
one
I
by Chris Golden and one by Madeline Robbins.
I believe I got the Chris Golden one.
Okay, yeah.
Was there a Nick Fury book in there as well?
Yes, there was.
Will Murray?
Yeah.
I remember it well.
That was one of the last ones we did.
I was a fan.
But that was my project, and I had been talking with JM about doing a Spider-Man story, and it just never happened. But we had talked on the phone a lot, but I never actually met him until New York Comic Con this year.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. So that was a thrill, because he was always one of my favorite writers. I mean, when I was growing up as a Marvel zombie in the 80s, and... you know, I mean, everybody was talking about Chris Claremont and John Byrne and Frank Miller and Walt Simonson and those guys, and like they were okay, but for me, it was Demetis. I was like, I love Demetis.
I'm with you, man, and
I've always been a huge fan of his. Moonshadow is still one of my favorite pieces of work.
Absolutely, ever. Absolutely. It's funny how it went, and I don't know if Mark and John Muth own it now. Or what? I know Vertigo brought it back a couple of years ago, and it's a great book, and I think. you know, that's evidence that the guy really is one of those great creators that can really write any type of story.
Yeah.
I understand you do a podcast?
Yeah, I'm part of a group that does a podcast called The Chronic Rift. It's a pop culture podcast mostly covering science fiction, comics, fantasy, horror, gaming, animation stuff. We do panel discussions, we do reviews, we do interviews, we do all sorts of views, and it's usually two or three times a month, and I'm one of the three or four hosts, and I also do TV reviews on it, called Couch Potato Salad.
Who are the other hosts?
Way back, once again, back to the mist of prehistory, the 1990s, me and some friends from high school and college, John Drew, Renthal Hawkins, Andrea Lipinski, Judy Fenari, we all got together and did a TV show on New York City Public Access Cable called The Chronic Rift. Similar type of thing. We had panel discussions, we did interviews, we had review segments. That lasted for 4 years, and then we all moved on with our lives. And then last year, John got us all together. We're still all friends, and said we should bring back The Rift as a podcast. And we all went, okay. and it's been working out beautifully. We've been having a lot of fun with it. You can find out more on the web at chronicrift.com.
And it's Chronic Grift.
Chronic Rift.
Oh, Chronic Rift. Thank you.
A hole in time.
Okay, very cool. All right, because, I want to get this right, because that's really cool. Well, what are the backgrounds of everybody else? Are they?
Well, we're all just, you know, geeks.
That's cool. All right, so you're the only working geek as far as is still working?
I guess so.
Okay.
Some of the other segments are done by people who like to reviews and are also writers, but I think I'm the only one who actually makes a living off this. Two of the hosts are teachers.
Okay.
And one is a librarian who does book reviews.
Oh, that's cool. Hey, man, what are you talking about? Librarians are helping you know, get the word out about genre fiction all the time. I think that's wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
That's really cool. Well, that's great, man, because, you know, I've met a few other people at cons who did, like, public access shows in the 90s and stuff. Because that's, you know, I there are some people that really think podcasting is like, hey, we invented the wheel. And it's like, yeah, and guess again. There were tons of genre shows covering this stuff from a local standpoint for years on radio and public access TV. And I think that's great. And I'm glad to see that, you know, some of you guys want to keep going, because a guy that I met at WonderCon was doing a show in Philadelphia for years on public access. And I'm like, dude, at the very least, get the old videos and, like, put them on YouTube or whatever. Because,
We've been doing that with The Rift, too. We've been putting up old episodes, and boy, is that just scary to look at.
Well, did you ever?
You know, we're all in our 20s, you know, and now we're looking at it like, damn, did we really look like that?
Well, did you get writers? Did you get guests or anything for the?
Oh yeah.
Who'd you have on?
We had Peter David on. We
very
had
cool.
Terry Bisson, Ellen Datlow. We did some interviews with some actors. We had Conrad Brooks.
Who's that?
He's a horror actor.
Okay.
I can't remember her name now. She was on Dark Shadows. One of the women was on Dark Shadows.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. Lana. Isn't her name Lana something?
No.
Okay. Then I don't.
Or it might be. It's been so long. We had a whole mess of different authors, artists.
Cool.
We did 100 episodes.
Did you have comic book people on or no?
Huh?
Did you ever have comic book people on or other than Peter David?
No, we did. And of course, I'm not remembering any of them now.
Okay.
But we had Joe Duffy on a few times. Patrick
oh, very
Duffy,
nice.
Patrick Daniel,
oh, that's
on.
Cool.
I'm not remembering who all.
No worries, man. No, that's cool.
There were
man.
A bunch of people.
So thechronicriff.com is where you can find Keith's podcast.
There's no the in the URL. It's just chronicriff.com.
Chronicriff.com. Okay. That's excellent, man. Well, good for you. I think that's great. I mean, you know, you hear about sci-fi and comic podcasts all the time. And, you know, I'm always curious to hear another good show. So that's awesome. Very cool. I'm a fan, man. No, I quite agree. Well, this has been a good education, and I really appreciate it for the Star Trek.
We didn't even talk about all the other 500 properties I've written.
Well, there you go. No, I know, man. And forgive me, because I really am. I'm a huge Star Trek fan, and I really was, you know, excited
to. And most of my output has been Star Trek, so that's, you know, not exactly a problem. You know, I've also done Supernatural, CSI New York, Andromeda, Young Hercules, Buffy.
I see Resident Evil books here.
I novelized all three Resident Evil films.
That's cool.
And I've done a World of Warcraft book, and I've done a StarCraft book, and I'm working on another StarCraft book. I'm doing a StarCraft manga for Tokyo Pop.
Oh, that's fun. When's that coming out?
December. The first volume is supposed to hit in December, if all goes well.
Excellent. Any other comic book stuff that we haven't covered?
At the moment, Farscape is an ongoing concern, so that's going to be... That'll be going on for the foreseeable future, and you know, we're looking at doing other different things. I mean, there'll be the main post finale series, certainly. We're looking at doing other things, you know, along the lines of Dargo's Lament in terms of, you know, supplementary type things.
Okay.
But nothing's nailed down yet. That's just so basically it's stuff we're talking about and saying, yeah, it'd be cool if we did this, but that's as far as we've got.
Okay. Well, I think on the strength of the first issue selling as well as it has.
That's prompted a lot of the talk about it. Is like, okay, well, people obviously want to see this stuff.
Well, and I should ask.
I've got the Star Trek coming one shot coming out in April.
Yes.
And the StarCraft manga, it's at least three volumes. The first one in December. The other two will be out in 2010.
Okay.
There's another comic book company I'm talking about something with, but it's another licensed property. But that's very much in the early stages.
Okay.
So I can't really talk about that yet. And I've also got another comics proposal in with, a couple different publishers that could mean fame and fortune or could be dashed on the rocks of rejection as usual. So.
Well, good luck with that, man, because honestly, I like I said, I've really enjoyed the Farscape comics so far. And now I'm looking forward to reading some of these Star Trek books, man. I enjoyed the Starfleet Corps of Engineers stories, and I'll look for more of your stuff. And this has been an education. I appreciate it.
Excellent.
Neat stuff coming up from Keith R.A. DeCandido. And make sure you check out his books. You can find a good listing for them at all the various online bookstores. Just type in Keith's name. And also visit his website, DECANDIDO.net. And that will take you to a listing of his various paperback books and should probably give you some information about what's coming up comic book-wise as well. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, continue to follow us here at iTunes, at newsarama.com, of course, our own website, wordballoon.com. Check out our backlog of so many other programs. If you have any questions or comments about the show, make sure you hit the Word Balloon forums at wordballoon.com. Hosted by Brian Bendis and Jinx World. Thank you, Brian. And also, if you have any other questions, you can Twitter me at John Word Balloon. Also, email questions at john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2009.